For today's episode of Unfiltered, we tackle a staggering reality. The United States, with only about 5% of the world's population, holds 25% of the world's prisoners. This raises a critical question. Does the US prison system perpetuate the oppressive legacy of slavery? In hopes for some perspective, I'm joined by James Nelson, an abolitionist who at just 19 years old was sentenced to life in prison for a murder he didn't commit. Now a free man, James shares his insights on why abolition is not just a vision, but a viable path forward to achieving true democracy. James, you grew up in LA in the 70s. I always like to start these conversations by returning to innocence because I like to get a feel for someone's beginnings. Having said that, can you access one of your first childhood memories?
I could go back to one of my childhood memories that really like sticks out. Growing up playing sports, like right in the streets. There used to be enough rooms in the community where we could play football on the streets, but that's not true today. You know, at an early age, just out there playing football, getting pulled over by the police playing football. So that always like stuck with me as far as like how we was already not even knowing at the time, but part of the marginalizing that was taking place in our communities.
And how does that memory, if in any way, affect you in the present? Do you access it for reflection, motivation, inspiration?
Yeah, I use it for motivation and determination because what I seen that was going on in our community at an early age and then just living up under that. You know, being harassed by the police, being kids all the way up to the age of 19. At that time, though, our elders didn't realize or believe that police could be so corrupted.
What were they believing?
If they stop you, you must have been doing something wrong.
And so how were they telling you to react to police brutality or police harassment?
Pretty much comply, listen to them, do what they say, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Bringing it forward to today, I understand you're an abolitionist. When it comes to abolition, there are a whole range of things that we could abolish. In your cause, what's the main point that you would like to see abolished?
Prisons. Prisons, because prisons is a money-making machine. Some years ago, one of the governor even called it the biggest fleecing of America. You have officers and other personnel that work for CDC that get extra amounts of overtime. They get hazard pay. They get a lot of bonuses off of the miseries of a lot of other folks. And then not to speak about how many folks that's actually in there for something they didn't do.
Right, right, which we will get to.
Yes.
But you say it's a money-making machine and it's designed, therefore, to put as many people as they can away, lock up as many people as they can. But it's a certain type of people that they want to put away, right?
Yeah, black and brown. Black and brown has always been the target. And we look at our population here in society, it's a low number. I only think it's double digits as far as the black population in society. But when you look at the black population incarcerated, it's a high number, you know. So systemic racism has always been like that. If you go back to documentary 13, you mm-hmm. know, you could, I watched that and that was the best documentary I ever seen that put everything in a nutshell as to what our ancestors was going through back then. Why are we still fighting the same fights today? And it just really made sense to me. So that's why I'm unapologetic about being an abolitionist, because it's a system designed to keep folks oppressed, black and brown folks.
When you speak about abolition, a lot of people that I hear that don't want to accept it or don't want to even entertain the thought, they say, well, then what? What are you going to do? Where are you going to divert the resources? How do you respond to those naysayers?
A lot of people, they out here and they in survival mode. People can't understand that unless they've been there. People get jail for being houseless. People get jail for their addictions. You know, these are things that people shouldn't get jail for. These are things that people supposed to like really have some real alternatives to whatever they're going through. But because it makes money, the county, the city, the country, you know, they look at incarceration. That's why mass incarceration had bloomed so big in the 80s. It was 12 prisons in California. Now, it's, last I stopped counting, it was over 30. It was over 30. So, you know, and there's a reason why, you know, it got so big to where they was sending folks out of states in private prisons where it was still profit being made off to these folks. But it was really no resources or no help for the situation that these people was first put in jail for. So then people come home not having their illness address. If anything, they come home and they worse off now than they were before their incarceration. And again, with no resources, because the resources is not going to the people that really need it. Here, the county, they play us against each other.
What do you mean by that? That's a great point. They play you against each other. What do you mean?
Divide and conquer. Divide and conquer. So when I say that, you know, you see some black folks, some brown folks formerly incarcerated, but then when they do their work and things that they fight for is not for community, it's for probably personal gain or working off somebody else's agenda, but these faces are being used for other folks' purposes. A lot of times people don't like me because of the things I say. But there's only two reasons that they wouldn't like me, either because it's true or because I said something. Mm-hmm. You know, so those are, you know, just some of the things that we deal with here, you know, as far as just really being on the right side of the fight. And I tell a lot of my coworkers, I tell them all, anytime a conversation become about you or myself, then either both of us or somebody is in the wrong field of work, because this work supposed to always be about getting somebody home out of a cage.
Yes.
Yeah.
What you were saying about aligning yourself with organizations who have a mission statement that seems to align with the values and what you're here to do. In your experience, how often does the mission statement actually add up to the actions that they're taking?
Some orgs start off with good mission statements, but in the midst of the fight and the backdoor negotiating, the demands get watered down.
Is that because they're also driven by profit?
Yes. 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 I see no other reason for it. You know, self-gain, you know, promotions or whatever it may be, it's all about it's being selfish. You know, this is a line of work that where you really need to be unselfish because it's not about you. You know,
right.
All money, not good money. You know, you can't accept funding from everybody because they want to give you money. Because when you accept their money now, you can't go down there and be an abolitionist. You can't go down there and be strong about your mission statement no more because you accept their money.
A really good friend of mine recently, he said, we're living in a very interesting time, Raquel. It's the first generation where people can make promises, not stick to their promises, and have no consequences for not sticking to their promises. He said, back in my day, Raquel, you would get killed for not sticking to your promise.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you have to say to that?
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with that. I do. You know, I was just talking to somebody the other day about integrity. Integrity is so missing, you know, but you have folks say that they have integrity. They would do the right thing, but soon as no one's watching, they don't do the right thing. You know, it need to be consequences. People don't like to, I think, be confrontational in this work, but I think a lot of times you have to be confrontational.
Yes.
Especially if you're serious about your mission statement and you're serious about staying in existence to continue to help those that you don't even know yet, that's still in prison, trying to go to the board to get a parole date so they can come home. And so we can help them navigate through the things I hear that's real tangible things that they need to know, because a lot of these folks, they've been gone for decades, but they get to come home to a transitional house. And because these transitional houses have these relationships with CDC, now they are being subjected to take programs inside of these facilities. Now, to get found suitable, you have to take programs first. So these folks have already taken these programs to even be let out to come home. But now once they're here, because of all the bureaucracy that's attached to it, now these people got to sit in these transitional houses. It's no real family reunifications because they can't go be with their families because they need to be here to take this program. So these places could get their funding from CDC. People is not really having an opportunity to go out and get employment because of the schedule that they need to be in these houses to take the programs. So it's really a setback. But again, it's a profit for those that's willing to compromise their positions.
Before as well, you said the only people that can really make changes are the people that have lived through this. I'm a big believer for you to help a cause. Like, I don't want to go to therapy with someone who has no idea about my life experience and my life travels. Mm-hmm. Makes no sense to me. We spoke about police harassment. We spoke about mass incarceration. How did these two things tie into your personal experience? Can you share that?
Yeah. Well, going back to when I was talking about earlier, as a kid, being harassed in the street playing football, it didn't stop there. It landed me in juvenile hall a couple of times. And when I was 19, it landed me in prison with a life sentence for a murder I didn't even commit. I passed a polygraph test before I was even arrested. Since I've been home, I paid for another polygraph test out of my own pocket, passed both of them. You know, it's just compelling evidence to show and prove that I didn't do it. But I was in L.A., part of LAPD, Rampart crash scandal. I got caught up in that. You know, I got caught up in that. Until today, nobody even want to look into it now, even with the evidence. My attorney did an actual innocent up under the integrity unit that DA Gascon have going. It's hard to even get them to hear you on anything, but to get an actual innocent presentation, it speaks volumes. But now, even after that presentation, I'm being told because I'm out of custody that my case don't have a priority. It shouldn't matter if the true interest is the truth.
Right.
And justice. It should not matter if I'm in custody or out of custody. It should even have more weight because I did a life sentence that you guys gave me and God seen me through it. And I'm home now. And I'm still adamant about what happened to me. So it should bring more weight to why you need to listen and look into this. Because again, I don't ask them to take my word. Take the transcripts that you convicted me on. And you won't even understand how I got convicted after reading those transcripts. But after all those years in prison and working through private investigator, read through the statements that we found out, the witness that they used that was juveniles for leniency in their own case, right? And then look at a witness that I never knew about that was with the guy when he got killed that was not called to trial because she said in her declaration she wouldn't go along with the coercion and pick the photo that they wanted her to pick. So she was never called to trial, but she was with this guy when he got killed. Her brother got called to trial, some of her other friends, and she said that she don't even know how they got called because they wasn't even right there when it happened. So things like that had a big impact on my life. But being in prison, it was hard to accept and all that. I still was just trying to, like, just be myself, right?
How much time did you do?
I did 29 years.
Nearly three decades.
Yeah.
And just mentally, mental strength to get through that, knowing you were innocent and realizing that no one cared.
Yes.
How does that not break you?
They say when life gives you lemon, make lemonade. So that's what I did. Worked on myself. Even though I was in there for something that I didn't do, I still was a part of a lifestyle. I was a gang member before I went in there. So, you know, I still had some work to do on myself. So if one day they let us come home, I could come home to be a better person. But I started that transition in there, doing programs for myself and then started doing programs for other folks. Did a program called Life Cycles, Careless Use Corrected by Life Experience. And in that program, I met a young man and he is the one, when I finally got found suitable, we was on lockdown. But he brought me a sealed letter to my cell and say, this from Richie. And the letter say, hey, go holler at these folks. They want to talk to you. And it was Dignity and Power Now. So that's where I work at now. That's where they gave me an opportunity and a platform to create what I wish would have been here for me when I had came home versus all the other things that we had to take in these transitional houses and all this repetitive self-help groups, programs that we already taken. So now in my program, folks get brought up to speed with technology. Because technology could really screw you over right here if you don't know what you're doing, just a click of a wrong button. So, you know, we tend to show folks like technology leadership building and get more into the work and how they can also use their voice for this work and make changes in it. Building your credit, opening up a banking account. You know, a lot of these stuff, these folks, even myself, we didn't have none of that when we left. Remember, I was 19. I wasn't even paying bills. I was still living with my parents. I would help out on bills, but for bills to have my name on it, you know, this was all new to me. So I had to come home, and I'm still learning. I'd be home 9 years in October, but I'm still learning. But I just try to, like, give folks what I know that I wish I would have had when I came home. And it's genuine. It's sincere. You know, this, they can call me anytime. And I tell them all the time, you know, this line of work, you don't have a day off because if somebody in the crisis and they look for you as a mentor and you tell, I'm off today, I can't talk, right? But this person is going through a crisis, right? So to me, you just got to be available for folks.
Unfiltered will be back shortly. Thank you for supporting us by listening to this episode's sponsors. Thank you for listening to this episode's ads. By supporting our sponsors, you support Unfiltered to continue to deliver quality content.
Something you said that was really interesting was what they were making you do was trapping you in these continuous cycles of self-help programs. How is that a trap to keep you in your trauma?
I don't know. I think self-help is good because a lot of self-help was created by us because we had started reading our transcripts after being denied and seeing the reason why we was denied and start finding answers for these things where we was able to develop insight, responsibility, and remorse. In some cases, it wasn't remorse. It was empathy. So for me to have all that and still maintain my actual innocence, that showed that anybody could do that. Self-help, like I say, is good, but it's on the person, how they gonna internalize it, and then how they going to utilize it throughout their life. So it could be good, but then it could also be used as a, a money-making machine, like we talk about now, you know, because people go through these groups and they take them, and if they're sincere about it, then they should have internalized some things. Just like we had to take these programs and internalize it and then be able to articulate yourself. And when you really serious about the program, when you articulate yourself, it's language that you're going to say. And that's what the board listens for.
Right. Yeah. That's a great point. Can you go into that?
Well, it's like if somebody had to go through the steps, 12 steps and stuff like that, right? They expected you to know the steps because if you live in them, you should know them. And then it's just like each case is different. So how each person was able to articulate themselves around their situation, their cases, right? And find a way to accept some responsibility. And again, it's just the language. I haven't been in it in a while, so it's a language that they listen for. And they know that if you in that group, you talking like this, you've been in there, you've been paying attention.
And what I'm hearing from you is that it requires you to start with an inner transformation. Like look at yourself and see, hey, how did I end up here? Not that even if I was wrongly convicted, what can I do within myself to make changes? But from that point, what your program is doing is the building blocks to transform your external reality as well. How can I live in a way that's conducive to who I am?
Yeah.
And that's what you see as beneficial for most of these people coming out. That's what you wanted, and that's what you're providing.
Yeah. And like I say, these programs, a lot of us created them to help us. And we got jacked for that too. By the state of California. They took ownership of the programs that we created, right? But then even when that happened, even before I came home, we was like, well, They did that. But what we can do is take all your tools out your toolbox and take them with you. That way you have your tools to utilize even after you walk out that prison. It don't matter who take the credit. You go out there and do your part to be with your family and to be the best person you could be and help others at the same time.
That comes back down to integrity. I'm from this generation. We're born without it. You know, like, I know for me, I can make promises and there are no consequences when I just say, oh, I changed my mind. We change our mind all the times.
Yeah.
What consequences could we be enacting now to help my generation take life a little more seriously, take commitments more seriously, take purpose on purpose?
Yeah. I don't know. That's kind of open. Like, because I think it's either you have it or you don't. I don't think it's something that you could, like, train somebody to do, because either it's in you or it's not. I can't take people through a curriculum to show them how to now be honest. You know, either you're going to be honest or you're not. So I just think it falls in, like, right there. I think, though, as a collective or as a group, as an organization, I think it's things that could be done in settings like that to hold folks accountable, where it's consequences when people waver outside the mission statement, the views of an organization or of any other group, when you're moving in a way that where it become problematic. I think it should be repercussions, because I think when it's repercussions and others see that it's repercussions, they're going to see that they're not playing. If it's not no repercussions, they're going to say, okay, now everybody else going to do what the other person got away with. So I just think that it has to be lines drawn, and people have to know that you're serious about these lines, because at the end of the day, the reason we're here is serious. Folks is dying on the daily in the county jail. August already. It's been, 20-some deaths this year in the county jail. That's how serious this work is. So that's how serious you have to be about it, and showing others that you're serious about it.
When we talk consequences as well, to hit them where it hurts is really to take their money, right? Financially hit them. It seems that that's what they care about. So why not take it from them and redirect it?
Yeah, it could be many ways that it could take place to get the message across. And the first time don't have to necessarily be hitting folks in the pockets, because, again, everybody is struggling or having a hard time.
As in the organizations.
As in the organization, right? I think that it could be gradual actions taken. If the person don't get you the first time, then I think the next one, it should be more severe. And if it happened to become where it's penalizing them financially, then these are choices that they made. You're worrying about or crying about getting hit financially when we out here trying to support a family whose loved one just been murdered in the county jail by the sheriffs. And I tell my coworkers all the time, if you ever put me in a position to where I have to choose, then you lost already, because I'm always going to choose community.
I want to finish it on a personal and then a collective note. So on a personal note, you mentioned before you've been out for 9 years.
Yeah.
Where are you at today in your exoneration process?
Yeah, I don't know where I'm at. I'm just sitting and waiting and waiting, and don't seem like they're going to say nothing. But I'm not asking or looking for no favors. You know, I'm just looking for you to sit this paperwork down, go through this paperwork, and determine what happened. Determine about the coercion from the police officer. Determine about the coercion with my attorney, Morris B. Jones, who then went to the bench after my case and years later declined to talk to my then attorney on my appeal. You know, so it's a lot of corruption that I think took place in my case.
The irony of it all is that all you're asking them to do is what they say the system is designed to do.
Exactly.
Truth and justice.
Exactly, exactly.
On that point, as an abolitionist, get rid of that system.
Yeah.
Where are you at with the work you're doing in the abolition space with mass incarceration, with the programs you're running? Where are you at now, and where do you see yourself heading?
With the program that I do, we have a support group that's over 100 some folks in it. So keep that going on and on. And it's not always just about work. We fit to get together, bring the family, bring the kids, and just bring your chairs and hang out in the park and eat.
What about play some sports like you did when you were a child?
Well, we always talk about playing sports, but I think we done got too old now. I think we just sit around and watch now. But, stay active and do stuff like that. We do yoga in the park. We go to, like, Laker games, you know, as a group, bike rides at the beach. So we do a lot of things. Right now, we still trying to get the county to implement some of our wins. Here recently, we was able to stop 2 jails from being built here in L.A.
That's massive. Congratulations. That's huge.
Yeah. Stop $4.5 billion from being spent on 2 more jails. And then one of the jails that they was going to build was for the women out in Lancaster. And the ground was proven to be contaminated with Valley Fever. And they still was going head on with it. And they told us they already committed to it, so they can't stop it. But we didn't stop. And we was able to get that stopped. And they all knew it. All the board of supervisors knew it. They had an environmental report that came back for the second time. The soil was contaminated for Valley Fever. So the county, again, is looking at the dollars. They don't care about the black and brown folks that they was going to house there. They didn't care about their staff that they was going to house there. Because Valley Fever don't discriminate.
That's a point I wanted to touch on, because you mentioned that part of your mission is to abolish in a black and brown-led movement, right? So what are the challenges of black and brown collaboration in the LA area, considering the long history of separation between the two groups?
I think that depends on, like, what corner of LA that you're on or what individuals you're talking to. Because it's a lot of folks out here that's still caught up on distorted beliefs and traditions. But it's a lot of us that realize that we were caught up on distorted beliefs and traditions. And then we had an opportunity to go sit down somewhere and then mature and to become adults. And you're not grown just because you say you're grown. You show you're grown by your actions. So it's a lot of friendships and brotherhoods that was established in prison. And we still all communicate, hang out together today. It's just unfortunately, some folks come home and they land on the wrong team as far as in this fight that we need in our communities to push back on this racial discrimination and it being marginalized and stuff like that. And we, as ex-lifers, know what risk assessments is. I got judged on risk assessment for 29 years. You need to come on and just be honest with yourself and admit to what you did so you can get out of here. That's what their risk assessment was telling me all that time. So again, risk assessments, they racist and biased. ACLU said it. But again, it's folks that come home. I think we all come home. We looking for work because we need to live. We need to work. And I think folks get the wrong job with the wrong people. But now you're in a situation. You have all these bills coming in and car notes and all that. Again, though, it's not about us. It's about those that we left behind, those that's still in the jails, those that's still being murdered in the county jail. That's who we need to keep the focus on. It's not about us. We got a chance to get out here. We got a chance to go find a better job. We got a chance to make some free decisions out here versus the folks we're here for. They don't have none of that. We're just trying to get them to that point.
Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of Unfiltered. It's so nice having you here in 2024. If you'd like to know more about the work that James is doing in the space of abolition, please check the links that we've included in our show notes.